Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Roslevy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. On Connect the Dots, every week we talk with different thought leaders, scientists, experts, healers, practitioners from all across the spectrum to connect the dots between the personal health we experience and our total health environment. That includes the health of our food, water, and air, the health of our communities, the health of our society, and of course the health of our planetary ecology here on planet Earth. So it's my delight every week to talk to people who have a different outlooks on ways that we can put together all of the different sources of wisdom and knowledge of science and understanding that are coming to us from a variety of different disciplines to really see a connected whole of the entire context for our life and our health and our habitat. I am a 25-year health journalist reporting on health and began reporting on personal health with personal health and lifestyle recommendations, working with health leaders in the integrative health community over many years. I gradually began to see that as much as leading a healthy lifestyle is an important foundation for health for everyone as an individual, that many different things that we really live in a context. The food that we eat, the water we drink, the air we breathe, the temperature of our home and climate that we live on, all are interactive with our environment, and moreover, as human beings, we're all connected. So there's a lot more to health than what we can address purely as individuals, although that is certainly the first step in health awareness and health activism. So in this show, we explore what goes on from there in terms of how a whole range of vectors and factors from our context impact our health and how we can become active participants in shaping those to create a healthier environment for all of us. So I'm especially delighted to have on today's show, given our theme, two dedicated professionals and thought leaders who really have been leading the way in terms of really looking at how health and environment are connected and how to better and improve that connection. My guests on today's show are Elise Miller, who's the director of the Collaborative on Health and the Environment. That's an international partnership of researchers, health professionals, and advocates committing to strengthening the scientific and public dialogue on the impact of environmental factors on human health. So that's a total fit for Connect the Dots. And with us as well today on the show, I'm very honored to have Dr. Ted Shetler, MD, Master of Public Health. He is Science Director of the Science and Environmental Health Network, as well as Science Director of the Collaborative on Health and Environment. So we'll be talking more about their organizations and their perspectives and views. And they are collaborators, and we're all actually in a collaborative between our individual needs and the needs of our families and communities and the greater needs of our society and our environment in sustaining health and protecting the sources of life. So I'm so honored to have both of you with me today and Connect the Dots. Welcome, Dr. Shetler and Elise Miller to Connect the Dots.
Thank you, Allison. It's a pleasure
to
be here.
Thank you, Allison. Really appreciate having the opportunity.
Well, your work is so valuable and really needs to be better known by all of us. You know, one of the things I've done numerous programs featuring the Initiative for Safer Chemicals, the change of the Toxic Chemicals Act. We've done a lot of programs on food, on the impact of fracking chemicals, and fracking extraction on water and as well as on agriculture. We've done shows on GMOs. So, you know, we've done a lot to sort of raise awareness here on Connect the Dots of all of these various things. And I just want to begin noting, Elise, from your bio that you have also served on the board of directors of the Endocrine Disruptor Exchange, as well as on the National Advisory Board of the Children's Environmental Health Network. And, of course, one of the ways that people first begin to wake up to some of the impacts of things that we can't always control through personal health choice, because they have to. Some things can be avoided through personal choice, like there's been rising awareness of the role of endocrine disruptors. There's increasing science looking at BPA and where we get exposed to it and what kind of health impacts that has. But we're really becoming more sophisticated in our understanding of what are substances that are in personal products and in beauty products and in industrial products that, in fact, disrupt the balance of the functioning of the endocrine regulatory system within the body. And so there's been an increase in childhood illness as the most kind of tangible impact of this, and growing public awareness of this. And I'm interested as well that Collaborative on Health and the Environment, your organization, really began looking into toxic chemicals many, many years back. And Ted, I know that SANE, your organization, the Science and Environmental Health Network, has really been pioneering as well in articulating the precautionary principle, which has to do with looking at the possible impacts of substances to which many people are exposed, without, in the absence of science or prior to science, instead of plunging ahead and exposing us and then having the kind of health impacts we have been seeing, like really taking a step back and considering what some of the risks that we were incurring are and finding ways to lessen that risk. So can you kind of bring our listeners up to speed on the history of how that began and kind of where things are trending now?
Allison, go ahead, Ted.
Allison, were you asking specifically about the precautionary principle?
Well, yes. Let's talk about the precautionary principle as an approach to the use of toxic chemicals in across the board, because that's kind of where this begins many people in terms of awareness.
Sure. Okay. Well, the precautionary principle is an idea that has a long history that actually found its first articulation in Europe, but has been part of the public dialogue in the United States for many years. Briefly put, the precautionary principle says that when there are credible threats of harm, that precautionary action should be taken, even if some cause and effect relationships are not fully understood. It's important, I think, to sort of think about the various elements of what I just said, because first of all, it calls for credible evidence. That, and as you mentioned in your opening piece, sometimes the science is not completely understood. But the precautionary principle is not suggesting that we should act based just on some dream that we had at some point, but actually a close look at what evidence there is and recognizing that sometimes it's important to act even if we don't have full understanding of cause and effect relationships. The other point I would make is that the precautionary principle is not prescriptive in what it tells you to do. It simply says that precautionary action should be taken. This invites you then to consider the alternatives. And that opens up a whole range of opportunity to think about what is the wisest way to make choices on the earth with all the complex interactions that you just described, so that we minimize harm while maximizing benefits of the actions that we take. So it's both a science-based principle as well as an ethical imperative to act in a way that is protective of the things that we care about and love.
That makes a lot of sense. So basically, what we're saying is that, and going back 25 years, this principle was articulated because in many cases, new novel synthetic chemicals are developed or put into use or introduced into all kinds of personal products, building materials, beauty products, tin, cans that you get your food in, grocery store receipts, medicines, all across the board. And in many cases, these have not been fully studied, but you may have similar substances from which you can draw analogies. But why aren't these routinely being studied in advance of use? And how did that start, like going back 25 years, that we didn't routinely study things prior to allowing them to use? And where are we with science now, and where do we need to go?
Well, if you think back to the beginning of the pharmaceutical industry, there were a number of drugs that were put onto the market without adequate testing that ended up causing a lot of trouble, and so regulatory statutes were enacted that enabled the Food and Drug Administration to require pre-market testing. Now, you could argue about whether or not that's adequate in all cases, but mm-hmm. the fact is that that pharmaceuticals, in order to get onto the market, need to undergo safety testing through prescribed protocols in order to gain access to the marketplace. Industrial chemicals are very different. Industrial chemicals get onto the market without pre-market testing, and there's no requirement that they have it. Back in 1976, the Toxic Substances Control Act was passed. It was the first attempt to systematically regulate industrial chemicals. At that time, the tens of thousands of chemicals already on the market were simply grandfathered in and allowed to be continued to be used on the market without safety testing. And as you pointed out in your opening, there's now an attempt to reform the Toxic Substances Control Act that has been introduced in Congress in order to see whether or not we can put together a statute that would require pre-market evaluation of chemicals before they go on the market. So there is a difference. Pesticides are yet another group of chemicals that actually do undergo some pre-market testing before they're allowed to be used. Again, you could argue about whether or not that pre-market testing is adequate. In many cases, it clearly is not. So among these various groups of chemicals, there are various statutes that regulate their marketability.
And what has been the role, Elise, of the Collaborative on Health and the Environment in getting better science, better understanding of the shortfalls? What has your history been, and how did CHE come about to look into these questions?
Well, thank you, Allison. We actually are celebrating our 10th anniversary, having started in 2002. And one of the cornerstones of our work is certainly the precautionary principle. And looking more broadly, it's very clear that where and how we live, eat, work, play, and socialize profoundly influence our physical and emotional health. And that's starting in the womb throughout life. These various environmental factors are strong determinants of health decades later. And given that many of those who started or founders of CHE have a core expertise in chemicals, we decided to focus on their exposures and particularly engage groups, health-affected groups, such as those who have learning disabilities or reproductive health problems or cancer, neurodegenerative diseases, to help tease out the scientific evidence that's already available, as Ted was saying, and try to connect those dots to, you know, look through the scientific literature, see what we already know about the relationship between some of these exposures and various health endpoints. And by bringing attention to that scientific evidence, we've been able to work with some of these health-affected sectors to help educate them about the science and help those who are interested feel like they can then be voices for change in terms of leveraging chemical reform, other policies that really put health in the center. And so we really started with that intention of working with these health-affected groups who really are the best spokespeople, because, of course, it's personal for them, to speak about the emerging science and then help make some of those changes and work towards those changes in the policy arena.
That sounds terrific. What is the emerging science revealing, if you could give us kind of a highlight of that?
Well, I'll speak briefly to say some of the most revolutionary science that a number of our colleagues have been bringing to the foreground is in regards to endocrine disrupting chemicals. Not an easy word for the layperson, but it's becoming, I think, more and more known in the public media. And essentially, mm-hmm. these are chemicals that block or mimic hormonal messaging in the body, starting at the very, you know, conception of life. and they are essential to our development, and whether it's our endocrine system or our neurological system, our reproductive health system, every system in the body needs these hormones to express themselves appropriately as intended in order to be healthy, starting, you know, in childhood, throughout life. And when those are disrupted, it's a problem. And it turns out that many of the chemicals, many of the products, as you mentioned in the beginning, that we use every day, many of the building materials and so forth, contain these chemicals. And we are seeing some exponential rises in various chronic diseases and disabilities in which these chemicals may play a role. And part of our work certainly is to bring that information to public awareness so that people, A, know that this is a problem, and B, can then act on it both on a personal level in terms of making better choices in terms of consumer goods, but also working more broadly on the policy level where we need to see significant regulatory and policy changes that will protect public health.
Yeah, it's so interesting because, you know, it's a regulation problem on two levels. So if you have a regulatory problem in the government where a whole bunch of synthetic chemicals are unleashed without adequate study or precaution or preparation for their potential impact, then that is a looseness or a lack of efficacy in the regulatory process. And then it's so sort of ironic in a symbolic sense that the net result of that is that the regulatory system of the human body, person by person, community by community, can then be awry and affected in a manner that then leads to illness. And, of course, when people do become ill, or their children become ill, and when there are problems, with babies and kids and the younger generation, or adult illness, then it's immediately a crisis, and we're kind of in a triage mode. We're never looking back to say, how did this come about? What could we have done to prevent it? Both personally, in terms of personal avoidance, as well as on a societal level. Why is there that disconnect? I know this is a bit like of a philosophic perspective question, but why is there that disconnect where, you know, when we're ill, we jump into action, we want to treat it, but we don't think in advance about, well, what could be creating this problem so that we get better regulation on a policy level in order to maintain healthy regulation within the human body? Can either of you address the question of regulation within the human body? I think it's something that most of us don't think about. You know, we maybe think a little bit the body is a machine, it goes and it breaks down, I know not why. We couldn't function without regulation within the body. Could maybe Ted, you as a doctor, give our listeners a little bit of an orientation to that. I think it would be helpful in understanding this issue, really.
Well, we do have in our physiology what are called homeostatic mechanisms that tend to respond to all kinds of environmental input and help maintain our physiology. The default, hopefully, would be in a healthy mode of operation. And as you've suggested, it can be perturbed and go off the rails in various ways. And so I actually think that the way you opened this conversation by reminding us that individuals are members of families and communities and ecosystems and actually societies, using that sort of nested hierarchy kind of idea that comes from the world of ecology, is actually a useful way to think about this, because what we really have is complex interacting systems, many variables acting in complex ways where interaction is the rule. It's not the exception, it's the rule. And then our bodies are finely tuned through the lessons of evolutionary history to respond to that. And so we can begin to use some of the concepts like resilience, for example, to talk about how some people are more able to cope with certain environmental stressors than other people are. So this brings us then to this notion that we're dealing with environmental chemicals, such as Elise was describing, not only single chemicals at a time, but also mixtures of chemicals, and they're acting in a complex background, a complex nutritional background, complex psychosocial background, and so on. And it's our task to try to understand that and to think about how do we build resilience into that system, but also recognizing that when we're dealing with that kind of complexity, cause and effect relationships are very difficult to tease out. And so we often need to, if we really are thinking in a preventive mode, as you're asking about, as opposed to responding after the illness has appeared, if we really want to try to prevent disease, what we want to think about is how do we interact with this complex system in ways that maintains its resilience, maintains its healthy operating conditions through multiple interventions, recognizing that we're not always going to fully understand the extent to which each stressor is contributing to an adverse health outcome. And that's really the dilemma. It's the difference between medicine and public health in many ways. The medical industry, the medical profession often is responding to illness. The public health approach is to try to create the conditions in which people will be healthy. And I would suggest, just as you did early on, that an ecological health approach would be to try to create the conditions in which not only individual people and families and communities, but also the entire community of living things, living and non-living things that sort of support life, are maintained in a healthy set of conditions.
That's fantastic. So that kind of what strikes me about that is that when we're talking about, and this has come up repeatedly in what both of you have said, there is a key building block of science is, you know, cause and effect, a cause and effect relationship. You know, like two pool balls. You hit one ball and it hits the other ball, and you know, A effect produces B. And so obviously that's foundational in science, and a lot of science depends upon being able to trace a one-pointed interaction. But as you point out, in this whole nesting, there are many interactions all going on, you know, simultaneously or successively, you know, one after another, and we're impacted by all of them. And so we need to kind of go from one-pointed science to sort of a multi-pointed systemic science that takes in all of that, all of the different things, because that's the actual reality. So very often, you know, we as the health audience or the health aware audience, have been trained to kind of, or just as, you know, kind of modern educated people have been trained to look for, you know, what does the science show? But we define science in this kind of single-pointed way, and what you're pointing out is that we're in a multivarious actual reality. And how can science shift to capture and reflect and assess that?
Well, I think we're seeing a shift, actually. I think increasingly the scientific literature, whether it's the medical literature, public health literature, even social sciences, we're understanding that the reductionist science that you described, where we have these cause and effect relationships that are easier to describe because we've removed them from the context, the variables from the context in which they exist. That reductive science has been very useful, and we've learned a lot from it. And this is not in any way a plea to move away from that, except it is to say that we need to recontextualize that reductive science. So at the same time we're learning about things at smaller and smaller scale, we need to put them back together in the context from which we've taken them for study purposes, for research purposes. And this is finding voice now in what's called systems biology. Certainly it's been a part of the world of ecology for a long time, where scientists and research methods and statistical techniques and a variety of other things that need to come along with this are beginning to embrace this more systems-based context that you've just described.
Well, that's fascinating. Can you give us some sort of snapshots or previews of what kinds of things we're seeing or what kinds of things we're aiming to see through this new evolution in science. I mean, what are some of the understandings that you could share with our listeners about systems science and how that applies to biology and ecology? I think it's fascinating.
Well, in systems biology, there are some very interesting and complex studies going on that are trying to understand how what goes on within cells is influenced by, for example, the tissue or the organ context. So it's still at a fairly micro level, but building out from that. On the other hand, if we look in the world of epidemiology, what I see happening there is that people are increasingly interested in trying to understand how the context in which an individual or a community finds itself influences a response to an environmental exposure. So just to give you an example, asthma is an illness that has been increasing in prevalence throughout this country and in most countries throughout the world. And I think everyone understands that there are probably multiple reasons for this. We don't fully understand why, but we understand that many, many factors are at play, beginning, as Elise said, back in the development of the fetus and the development of the lungs, the immune system, moving on into childhood, exposures to various kinds of environments influence asthma likelihood and so on. One of the very interesting things that's beginning to evolve in the asthma research world is understanding how the socioeconomic status of an individual or a family influences the susceptibility to other environmental exposures. So, for example, people of lower socioeconomic status who live in a community exposed to traffic-related air pollution are more likely to develop asthma, as well as more likely to have an asthma attack if they already have asthma, compared to someone of higher socioeconomic status who lives in the same community who is exposed to the same amount of air pollution. That's very interesting. I mean, why should socioeconomic status make you more vulnerable, more susceptible to the exposure to the air pollution causing an asthma attack, or making it more likely that you'll develop asthma? And some of the biology of this is being worked out. People of lower socioeconomic status have higher baseline levels of stress hormones or inflammatory markers, for example, that it's a baseline condition that the way I think of it, it puts them closer to the threshold, easier to tip over the edge into clinical illness. So this is an example of how people are beginning to combine various stressors and various environmental variables in study design to see how they might interact and create what we're actually seeing in the world.
That's fascinating. That goes back to, I've been a kind of student of health, I would say, for quite a long time, and that reminds, what you're describing reminds me of the German and European model of biological medicine, the concept of total load, the toxic barrel or whatever, where a number of different factors combine until you get to a point where it creates a tipping point into illness. And we don't have a lot of scientific study of the different markers for that, or the different factors that are playing in, so that at least conventional medicine does not. Integrative medicine has some, so that it becomes possible to actually both look at what the stressors are upon the health of the public at large, as well as upon an individual, so that somebody knows, how near or far they are to the tipping point. So it sounds like the science you're describing begins to get us there. We're coming up upon the half-hour mark of the show, so we're going to take a break for station identification. And when we come back, I want to hear a little bit about the conference in New York that you have recently put on and some of the things that are coming up in the future of development in this area. So stay with us, listeners, on Connect the Dots for further conversation on the health and environment with Ted Shetler and Elise Miller.
Well, who, well, who, well, who, well.
Welcome back, listeners, to Connect the Dots. For the second half of the show, we're here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, and you can also listen to past shows in the archives under Connect the Dots at Progressive Radio. Today's guests are that we've been talking to for the last half hour and will continue in the next half hour. I'm speaking with Elise Miller, the director of the Collaborative on Health and the Environment, and also to Ted Shetler, who is the science director both of that organization and of the Science and Environmental Health Network. And I just want to point listeners that want to learn more, because this topic is so rich on today's show, to a couple of their websites where you can get a wealth of information. They're constantly updated. They have a lot of science and new developments in these areas, and I recommend them heartily. The Collaborative of Health and the Environment, the website is www.healthandenvironment.org. Pretty easy. That's a good one. also, the Science and Environmental Health Network can be found at www.sehn.org, and there are terrific articles and links on both sites, which I highly recommend. There's also another very interesting new site. We can talk a little bit about this theme as well. It's cumulativeimpacts.org, and that's really what we were discussing at the end of the first half hour of the show, and we'll continue with that, cumulativeimpacts.org. And I know that a lot of activists of various stripes listen to this program, so that's a place also where you can go to connect the dots on how all of these things incrementally, drop by drop, you know, millionth apart per millionth, and, you know, on and on from there, gradually add up and affect us, which is part of what we're talking about here, as well as affecting our environment. So before we move on, I want to talk a little bit about your recent conference, very exciting, at the New York Academy of Medicine just last month, and some of the exciting future directions for improving the health of the environment in order to improve human resilience and strengthen our communities. I want to hear more about that. But just to backtrack for a second, is there any kind of thing that you would have to add about the cumulative impacts topic, either you, Elise, or you, Ted, because we've been kind of discussing it implicitly without kind of saying the word. So is there any basic orientation you could give, and then we can kind of look forward to what evolved out of the conference that's so exciting in terms of how all of these issues can be evolved in science and addressed in social policy?
Well, I'll just jump in. This is Elise, to say that for many people, of course, the systems understanding is really a common sense understanding, and those who have been working in environmental justice, on social justice, you know, they really already get that on the community level, of course there are multiple impacts, of course they're interacting, of course they're having some influence on our health and well-being across the lifespan. And so on some level it's you know, common sense, and the science that we've been discussing in the last half hour is really pointing towards what in many ways we already know to be true, is that there are these multiple factors, and they do influence our health in various ways. And so the collaboratives, Collaborative on Health and the Environment, we also refer to it as CHE, has been taking what we've been focusing on in terms of our core competency around chemicals and really trying to make more accessible a systems-based understanding of contributors to health. And so this, we hope, is a way to find upstream opportunities for positive interventions. And it really is based in that concept of cumulative impacts, where, yes, it's the chemical environment, but it's also the social environment, the socioeconomic environment, the access to nature, natural environment, food environment, interactions between gene and environment, the epigenetics questions that are emerging right now. And so we really have to look very holistically at how these various factors, and of course in cumulative impacts you really say, okay, well there's these, you know, there's this factory next to the community, and there's also the socioeconomic questions that Ted was bringing up, There may be psychosocial issues related to that, that where there's abuse or violence, whether that's in the home or, you know, on the streets. And then you add, you know, that there's no natural environment nearby, and that, you know, those who are, the access to food is very limited. It's a 7-Eleven in the street corner. And so when you look at all of those, it is complex. It's hard to know. There isn't a, you know, clear cause-effect relationship, as we were discussing earlier. But to be able to articulate that systems understanding, I think we can move further and further upstream and leverage some change. And Ted may have something to add to that.
No, I think that's a very nice summary. Thanks, Elise.
Okay. You could, the two of you work together regularly, so it's pretty seamless there. So it sounds also that that really leads into your recent conference at the New York Academy of Medicine, because those are some of the things that you're looking at. What were some of the revelations of that, and what are some of the interesting projects or perspectives that came out of that conference going forward?
Well, I'll first talk about sort of the intention of that conference. Really was to bring together some of the leading thinkers, creative thinkers in science and health and education, nutrition, urban development, ecology, landscape architecture, and so forth, to really say we have to break down these silos. We need to start talking to each other. If we're going to have a whole systems approach to health, then we need to all work together, right? And so we saw this as an opportunity to really build on some of the incredibly instrumental movements of the past, like the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, the human health rights movements, and so forth, to really bring those values to the forefront again when we're thinking about health. And so our longer term vision is for that to catalyze these systemic changes in every sector of society, so we can establish those new patterns that really promote intergenerational ecological health across generations. And so what we did was to bring in experts in these different arenas, whether it was urban development and nutrition and toxicology and so forth. And then we also brought in people who have expertise in intergenerational approaches to health. So for some of us, that was really the first time we thought about, okay, how can, the seniors in our communities work more effectively with the youth and vice versa in community, so that we can, that's a key component of health. And then the third piece that we brought in was on arts and creativity, because of course, we need to develop our creative minds and creative solutions if we're going to address some of these dire concerns that we're facing right now. And so between those sort of three, what you might call matrices, the various factors that impact health, the intergenerational piece and the arts piece, we, I think, created a remarkably vibrant and unique conversation where we didn't use PowerPoints. We really wanted to focus on interactions, and we, again, helped provide an environment where people could allow their creative ideas to come forth in a place that was less inhibited and rigid in its format. And what was ironic, of course, is the New York Academy of Medicine has a rather staid interior, meaning we were in the musty library of the environment with all the old medical books and statues of older white men. And as Ruth Finkelstein, who is the vice president of the Academy, said in her welcoming remarks, we're really the Trojan horse. And that rang true in terms of our conference, was that though we were in this environment, again, based on some, obviously very important Western medicine that has helped elucidate a lot of our illnesses and infectious disease and so forth, and sort of saying, well, wait a second, we now have to bring those pieces together, as I think Ted was saying earlier, and to think more holistically and less reductionistically. And this conference, I think, was the kind of that interior of the Trojan horse that was sort of bursting forth with new ideas and ways of connecting and talking about issues. And so I'll just sort of, with that image, maybe turn it over to Ted for some of the ideas that he saw that came out, and I'll certainly elaborate on those as well.
Well, thanks, Elise. Yeah, I would agree it was this wonderful cross-disciplinary conversation that we typically don't have. And for me, that, I think, was the highlight. So I'll give you a couple of examples that stood out for me. There are, as Elise mentioned, there were people there. We had a group that actually teaches dance and music to elders in various community settings. And I had a conversation with that group about the possibility of actually introducing the idea of elders in extended care facilities, nursing homes, and others getting involved in raising their own food as a way of sort of making the whole idea of local food more real for people who probably have a lot of gardening skills that they've learned over the years. And also figuring out ways to integrate that with bringing youth into that. So you can imagine, and we've actually seen some places where this is happening, where youth and communities are getting together with elders and together sharing their experiences, but youth learning gardening skills, learning about where food comes from and how to raise it, and then moving that inside. So how we're raising the food, how about designing our own menus and preparing our food and putting that together with the creativity, dance, and music, and so on. All by ways of trying to cross the boundaries of the various subject topical areas, but also across the generations, which Elise mentioned.
So this is really mentorship, which is,
how do we build that in more regularly into our community life?
That's so interesting. So it's not only in disciplines that we've been sidled, but we've also been marketed to generationally, and there isn't that as much of an intergenerational dialogue as might have been true traditionally in smaller communities where everybody was kind of in place amongst, with exposure to all generations happening all the time. The it takes a village thing that's also gotten fragmented with a nuclear family and people living far away and from their elders or relatives and or the later generations. And so we're actually rebuilding. What you're describing is a rebuilding of almost a traditional, in the best sense, traditional social structures that have also been siloized, as have these disciplines. That sounds really very promising. My gosh, that's wonderful.
I would just add to that it invites us then to begin to think about the world that we are creating and leaving to future generations, not only those that are alive now, but those who are yet to come. Mm-hmm. And so it really opens up a conversation about what are our responsibilities and obligations to 2 and 3 generations down the road. What about 7 generations down the road? Live on the earth now and make decisions and so on.
Well, that's really a broader picture. That's how the Native Americans and other societies and cultures have traditionally planned and made decisions. But we've somehow gotten caught in a much shorter cycle where it's either, earnings per quarter or election terms, and all of that. And so we've kind of gotten hypnotized into these ever shorter and shorter cycles that cause us to lose sight of the longer-term human cycles that are really those that are sustainable for mankind and that preserve habitat and everything.
I think along those lines, if you don't mind my interjecting, the piece that in terms of the conference, we actually involved AARP, which I think everyone knows is many, many millions of members and a growing body of membership, given the baby boomers getting older. And we have just delighted to begin to develop that relationship with AARP, given their reach. And also those people are the ones thinking about their children and their grandchildren and what kind of legacy they're leaving. And and for a long time, they have not thought about the environmental piece, or at least haven't had that as a major priority. And now they have a blog on the environment, which is very exciting. And as a follow-up to our conference, we're planning to work with them to organize, you know, various breakfasts in different states on environmental health and how those and that sector might involve themselves as they become more cognizant of the legacy they're leaving and wanting their grandchildren to have a have the life that they were able to lead or one that's even better.
Yeah, that's very beautiful. That's a real resource in the fracking community, which I've been very involved with, the anti-fracking community, one should say, the fractivist community. There is that natural kind of partnership. Of course, there are people of all ages involved in protecting water, food, and air in the Northeast region where I'm active. But one frequently sees these cross-generational working relationships around an issue of concern as well, and where some of the battle scars from previous social policy initiatives or social initiatives come from the elders, and the dynamic energy and sort of new vision comes from the younger parts of the team and everything. Kind of co-creating, really. That's a beautiful, beautiful model for that. Congratulations that that's evolving. And I think the AARP initiative is incredible. So would people look to your site for upcoming kind of announcements of various activities along that line? I mean, how would any of our listeners who are interested in connecting with this in a very direct way kind of find out more about it? Is that kind of something you'll eventually have on your site, or, you know, are there public activities planned of any kind?
We do have lots of information on our site. We also have a Facebook page which contains a lot of the materials from the conference, including a sketchbook that one of our graphic designers came and spontaneously made sketches throughout the conference, which are just fantastic encapsulations of some of the highlights. We also have interviews of many of the conference participants, including people like Gail Christopher, Vice President of Program Strategy at the Kellogg Foundation, who's been a social justice leader for decades, really, and beautifully articulated short interview with her. We'll be posting more of those on our Facebook and our conference page. You can go to our website at healthandenvironment.org and look on the left-hand side of our homepage, and you'll find the conference there and the Facebook link. We also will be planning to post what we're calling an e-book, which will capture the highlights from some of the what we call the Thinking Forward Together sessions, where we focus on various questions and the ideas that emerge from those, along with other pictures and interviews, so that we could have kind of an e-book collage of what was what emerged from that conversation at the conference, and then the follow-up, which we hope to embody in some of the upcoming conferences in various sectors. For example, we'd like to have these type of cross-sectoral presentations at conferences where those might not have happened before, such as at the Smart Growth Conference, looking at the built environment. And though they're certainly thinking about these different sectors, to have a presentation where, someone who's steeped in toxicology is talking to someone who's thinking about urban gardens, and someone who's concerned with urban farms or whatever else may be needed in that particular community. And so we're going to these different conferences. We'll have a presence at the American Public Health Association. We're looking to, again, other conferences where we might bring these elements, including the intergenerational and creative elements, into that work, because it proves so inspiring to those who came to the New York Academy of Medicine.
Well, that sounds terrific. It's interesting because one of the things when we began at the start of the show talking about the strengths and some of the limitations of reductive point-by-point science, there's a fantastic book, and the name is eluding me right at the moment, but it's by a British psychiatrist, and he really talks about the over-emphasis, over-reliance upon that kind of science and that kind of reductive model as really being a function of the use of the, the right side of the brain, or I always get them screwed up, but in any case, I think it's the right side of the, or the left side of the brain, whereas the right side of the brain is more the creative side, and the side that would take in art and music and dance. And so actually, he said that throughout history, he said one is the master and the other is the servant, and the problem in our time is that the servant has come to dominate, and the master, the right side of the brain is more, has more of the arts, of the humanity, the holistic thinking. So it's actually a brilliant strategy that you have found, as scientists, have found the way to reach across the breach there and kind of enlist and co-create and engage both sides of the brain through accessing people with those kinds of strengths. And what often happens is that some of that more holistic thinking can be dismissed as sort of fuzzy or woo-woo or something of the kind, but actually there are core human values, strengths, and capacities embedded in it, which you're enlisting. And I think that's one of the most positive things on the solution side to addressing some of these troubling issues that, you know, that I've ever come across. So really, congratulations on that. I think that's a great thing for listeners to follow and tune into. Brilliant. How did you all come to that?
Well, I think we're certainly not the first. Be very humble and say this, that, you know, many people have been talking about the need over, you know, however long to integrate the, you know, left and right side of the brains, if you will, or these, you know, mind, heart, spirit, for some people. It really is to use all the different gifts that of our human capacity to their fullest in an integrative way that's going to allow us to address these very tough challenges that, you know, cannot be met by just getting more data and figuring it out intellectually. As important as that is, it cannot be the only way to find the creative solutions we need.
And contact with nature itself is resilience building as well. In fact, one of the great, that's why, you know, whenever there you go to a meditation class or anything else where they say picture yourself in a special place, they're not usually suggesting, you know, that you picture yourself in a steel tower, for example. They're
right.
Usually suggesting you place yourself on a beach, in a wood. There's a reason for even evoking that,
right.
As well.
We
as
even
for
had the U.S. Forest Service, someone from the U.S. Forest Service who's doing her doctorate in social science, and she was very articulate about that relationship. And of course, Richard Louv, Last Child in the Woods, has really brought that message home, I think, in a very popular media way.
So, Ted, we're coming near to the last just 2 minutes or so of our show. Any final words on the whole living system view or the conference for our listeners?
Well, let me just reemphasize what you've recently been talking about as being so terribly important, that people do respond to beauty and aesthetics and to the spiritual aspect of this ecological model for some people is terribly important and has real consequences. It has consequences for human behavior and enjoyment of life. Also has consequences for health in a very pragmatic, practical way. And so when we're searching for solutions and interventions, we should absolutely include the aesthetic dimension and the spiritual dimension for those for whom it makes sense, recognizing that this is not an add-on, that this is a very important piece of this larger model. And if we're looking for beautiful solutions, we may be looking for the right solutions often. So I would just reemphasize that and not in any way be apologetic for it, that this larger model can fully embrace this more comprehensive set of issues and topics that we know are so important.
Thank you. That's wonderful. I want to thank you both so much. Elise Miller of Collaborative Health and the Environment, Ted Shetler, also of Collaborative on Health and the Environment, as well as Director of the Science and Environmental Health Network. Thank you so much for being with us today on Connect the Dots and for the work you're doing. I hope listeners will go to your websites and get involved, healthandenvironment.org, SEHN.org, cumulativeimpacts.org, as well as the Facebook pages, Healthy Environments Across Generations Conference. Thank you for being with me here on Connect the Dots. Perhaps we'll be able to inveigle you on again at some point. And thank you, listeners, for being with us today. And Connect the Dots, tune back in next week, 10 a.m. Eastern Time, every week. I'm Allison Rose Levy.